Hello, I'm ISS Global Head of Research, Georgina Marshall, and welcome to our June Bulletin podcast for North America, focused today on executive compensation. On this podcast, we'll review this season's US and Canadian compensation landscape, looking back at interesting trends, key meetings, vote results, some regulatory developments, and shareholder initiatives. Joining me to talk about the season's top pay trends and key votes is Rachel Hedrick, a senior member of our US compensation research team, and Rishima Katuria, our Canadian compensation research expert. Rishima, let's start out with the big picture in Canada. What are your general impressions of the 2021 season and trends in pay to date?
This proxy season has been unprecedented in many ways. We've seen by far the greatest number of Canadian companies with say-on-pay votes on the agenda, along with an all-time increase in failed say-on-pay resolutions. So far, there were over 200 say-on-pay votes this season, an increase of 10% when compared with last year's season during the same period. This increase may be in part be explained by the proposed amendments under the Bill C-97, which requires certain corporations under the Canada Business Corporations Act to hold non-binding shareholder advisory votes on executive compensation. Corporations Canada launched public consultations on these proposed regulations, and written submissions were to be sent by March 31st, 2021. Along with the larger number of say-on-pay proposals, we also saw a marked increase in failed say-on-pay resolutions, which is relatively uncommon in the Canadian market. This season, we've already seen 5 failed resolutions and 1 company with only 60% support. Since the advent of these say-on-pay votes in the Canadian market, the highest number of failed votes in a given year was just 3. And last year, we only saw 1 such failed resolution. Along similar lines, the average say-on-pay support levels also decreased from 93.3% in 2020 to 91.8% in 2021. In terms of pay quantum, the median say-on-pay was $4.3 million, which was consistent with last year's numbers for composite index companies.
Thanks, Rishima. And Rachel, speaking of pay quantum, last winter there was discussion that 2020, i.e. what was reported in 2021, could be the first year in half a decade in the US with lower CEO pay than the year before. Did this pan out or did CEO pay continue to rise despite the pandemic?
Well, Georgina, despite the challenges of the pandemic, median CEO pay in the S&P 500 rose again from about $13.1 million last proxy season to approximately $13.3 million this year. However, outside of the S&P, median CEO pay in the remainder of the Russell 3000 does appear to have dipped a bit from a median CEO pay package last year of $4.1 million down to $3.9 million this year. But when we think about proxy season, we typically look at meetings through the end of June. So these numbers may shift a little bit, and I would invite our listeners to look at our upcoming U.S. compensation postseason report, where we'll report the final updated figures later this summer.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I wonder if you can see yet how investors have reacted to that in their voting, and particularly how did this year's U.S. say-on-pay vote results look compared to past years?
Well, support levels for 2021 U.S. say-on-pay votes were at the lowest level since the beginning of say-on-pay in the U.S. So votes in the Russell 3000 dropped from an average support level of over 95% last year to just around 91% for proxy season 2021. And the decline was even more pronounced in the S&P 500, where average support levels through the end of May were under 90%. The failure rate in the S&P was also higher than in the Russell, with 4% of say-on-pay proposals failing to receive majority support, which works out to be about 15 companies thus far. And this represents the highest failure rate seen for large-cap companies since the beginning of say-on-pay in the U.S. as well. The failure rate in the remainder of the Russell 3000, though, if you pull out those S&P 500 companies through the end of May, was more in line with historical averages, with 2.3% of proposals failing to receive majority support, which was about another 27 companies.
Okay, sure. And of course, 2020 was a year when many investors were wanting to support companies through the then unknowns of the pandemic. And many gave companies more flexibility or leeway, benefit of the doubt, if you like. So after a season in 2020 with very little formal activism or investor pressure, do you think SaonPay votes were affected by investor campaigns in 2021?
Sure. So these votes were certainly impacted more heavily this year, particularly, as you mentioned, following a rather light 2020 activist season around executive pay. Of course, that made sense given proxy season last year occurred during the height of lockdowns in the US. But conversely, this year, there have been several high profile Vote No campaigns that were focused on executive pay programs. So on our last podcast, we talked about Vote No campaigns at a few of the large pharmaceutical companies. These were waged by members of the Investors for Opioid and Pharmaceutical Accountability Group. And these were primarily related to large adjustments that those companies made to their incentive compensation to exclude costs related to the opioid crisis. And these settlement costs across four of the largest pharmaceutical firms in the US totaled about $26 billion. And in some cases also resulted in large litigation costs, which were then also excluded for incentive plan purposes. And while it's not unusual for incentive programs to exclude payments like these, the magnitude was very large in each of these cases. And at all three of the companies with meetings that have occurred, Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen, and Johnson & Johnson, the SaonPay proposal has received relatively low support of between 51 and 61%. But to also focus on a few new situations, at General Electric, CTW targeted a Vote No campaign around CEO Larry Culp's replacement new hire equity grant. It was valued at just under $60 million, and it had substantially lower stock price goals than his original new hire award from when he was hired in 2018. One of CTW's main points was that the new grant allowed for a sizable payout, even if the company's stock price remained below the level it was at when Culp was hired. And investors voted down that proposal. It received support of around 42%. Investors also sided with Vote No proponents at Park Hotels, where Unite Here urged shareholders to vote against the SaonPay proposal due to multiple large equity grants that were made during 2020. The grants were made in connection with an acquisition, but also for executive retention related to COVID-19. And that proposal received the support of just 18% of the votes cast, which represented one of the lowest SaonPay votes we've seen in the US so far this season. And then lastly, I wanted to mention two Vote No campaigns by the Teamsters. First, at Marathon Petroleum, the Teamsters opposed large severance payments, including an unusual new time-based equity grant to the retiring CEO. And the Teamsters also took issues with some of the company's contractual change in control related payments, including some potential pension enhancements for other executives. And the proposal at Marathon failed, receiving just 30% support. The Teamsters were then also active at XPO Logistics, opposing the SaonPay proposal there for multiple large equity grants to the CEO, as well as other concerns around their incentive programs. And the SaonPay proposal at XPO had a vote result of about 45.5%.
Thanks, Rachel. And what about vote results for other types of compensation-related proposals, shareholder proposals or equity plans, for example?
Well, so no executive compensation shareholder proposals have received majority support so far in 2021. The proposal with the highest support level got just under 44% support, and that was at US Silica Holdings. That proposal sought to incorporate more disclosure of non-GAAP adjustments into their proxy statement, which would include a line-by-line reconciliation of their incentive metric performance back to GAAP. One interesting note from the pharmaceutical industry to go back there, we didn't see any shareholder proposals asking companies to consider the risks of drug pricing on incentive programs this year, on their incentive program results. And this was interesting because those proposals were previously garnering somewhere above 20% in each of the last 2 years. But as I mentioned earlier with the Vote No campaigns, you know, perhaps some of those investors have focused their attention in other areas this year in that industry. And then regarding your question about equity plans, there didn't seem to be similar opposition to, as we saw to the SaonPay proposals, just two equity plans failed to receive majority support in the Russell 3000 at the meetings through the end of May.
Thanks, Rachel. And let me come back to you again, Rishima, to highlight for us the types of changes you saw to executive compensation programs in Canada in response to the pandemic.
Yes, sure. So last year, we communicated that the pandemic may impact the standard executive compensation programs in certain industries. And in order to assess the feasibility of the changes in executive pay, shareholders would need adequate disclosure to justify these changes during the unprecedented times. Now, as anticipated, many companies tweaked their pay practices due to the pandemic, including changes such as delaying STI target setting, implementing discretionary components, preserving cash by granting cash bonuses as deferred shares, and compensating the lost bonuses with an increase in long-term incentives. We also saw companies granting one-time awards as retention vehicles to the executives. Now, these companies were under greater scrutiny, and we adopted a holistic approach to gauge the appropriateness of these changes. One of the examples of a composite index company that made various changes to its pay practices due to the pandemic and received less than 50% support from the shareholders was Gildan Activewear. The company's business and operations were negatively impacted by the COVID-19, and the company made adjustments to its incentive programs, such as altering its STI metrics and granting discretionary bonuses at target. This actually led to an increase of 400% in annual bonus payout if we compare it with last year payout. Several other pay practices were highlighted as problematic, including a $7.8 million one-time award, which comprised of premium priced options and share appreciation rights. We also saw many Canadian companies that either already incorporated environmental and social metrics in their incentive programs or have indicated future use of these metrics in their incentive programs.
Thanks, Ushima. And let me put a similar question to you, Rachel. So circling back to the say on pay proposal itself, what executive compensation trends did you observe this year? And what types of changes or trends did you see to exec pay programs in the US in response to the pandemic?
Well, as expected and similar to Canada, the most notable trend to come out of proxy season was pandemic related pay changes that were made in 2020. We saw a number of discretionary bonuses, as well as equity awards that were meant to address companies' pandemic-related retention concerns. We also saw a number of companies adjusting outstanding long-term incentive awards, which was something that investors had indicated they'd be looking at closely during this proxy season. So to give an example, at Chipotle, the company excluded the period of March through May of 2020, which is arguably the most impactful period of lockdown in the U.S., from its incentive program performance results. And that effectively increased payouts for both their bonuses and their long-term incentive program. The say on pay proposal there received just over 51% support. On a more positive note though, regarding pandemic related pay practices, we didn't see a large upswing in the repricing of underwater options or the incorporation of exchange programs in the US. Both of these practices are considered by most investors to be problematic if they're done without shareholder approval. Given the stock price volatility in 2020, some thought that these practices might make a comeback, but that was largely not the case. And then lastly, also similar to the Canadian market, we continue to see a number of high profile companies. They're increasing their usage of environmental and social metrics in their incentive programs or promising to incorporate such metrics in the future. So some energy and manufacturing companies, for example, have incorporated environmental metrics into their programs in past years, but that practice is now expanding to other industries. So to circle back to Chipotle for a moment, Chipotle disclosed that their 2021 bonus program is going to include metrics focused on supporting sustainable farms, increasing racial and gender pay equity, and also reducing the company's carbon footprint. And then elsewhere in the consumer sector, two other well-known global brands, McDonald's and Starbucks, also disclosed that their 2021 bonus programs will include goals related to increasing gender and racial diversity in their management ranks.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Were there any other compensation-related controversies or continuing issues that have come up in 2021 so far?
Sure. So besides the two pandemic-related pay matters, there are two other ongoing issues that come to mind. First is very large pay packages, including those with front-loaded equity grants. They continue to be an area of concern for many investors. We counted 18 compensation packages in the Russell 3000 through the end of May, where the CEO received over $50 million in compensation. And then there were several more that received between 30 and 50 million. Notably, the largest compensation package of 2021 thus far was at Paycom, where the CEO received over $200 million in total compensation, including a $176 million special performance grant that's meant to cover his equity awards through 2026, which, even if you annualize it, is somewhere between $25 and $30 million a year. Investors voted down that say-on-pay proposal. It got just over 30% support, and they also voted against the only compensation committee member that was on that ballot who also failed to receive a majority. And then the second issue is we continued to see problematic severance payments, as well as the related disclosure remain an ongoing issue that we're monitoring and that we hear from investors about. This is a topic that we've discussed before, and we did again after the 2020 proxy season, and we've continued to identify companies in 2021 that are making sizable severance payments to executives whose terminations are being described in the disclosure as resignations or retirements. And most investors agree that severance payments are appropriate only upon an involuntary termination. The disclosure issue really seems to stem from some companies' reluctance to characterize a termination event as involuntary. However, we've heard from investors that they expect clear and accurate disclosure on the nature of executive terminations, as well as information about the contractual provisions that are triggered, particularly when the company is making large cash severance payments.
Yes, certainly. Very relevant. Thank you, Rachel. And I started the podcast with you, Rashima. So let me direct my final question back to you. I know there were several interesting votes this season. And as we wrap up, can you highlight a couple of key takeaways from the Canadian season?
Yes, certainly, Georgina. There were indeed many interesting meetings worth mentioning. To start with, Pay at Scotiabank, one of Canada's top five banks, was in the spotlight at its April 13 meeting. This was the second time when ISS recommended against the say-on-pay resolution at a major Canadian bank. Scotiabank's say-on-pay resolution garnered only 60% support from the shareholders. The bank's 1, 3, and 5-year TSR was the lowest among its banking peers, while the CEO's pay was ranked near the top. In addition, unlike prior years, the bank did not disclose thresholds for its annual incentive metrics, which was imperative as the results were below target on 3 of the 4 corporate performance metrics for 2020. Another meeting worth mentioning is GFL Environment, which was held on May 19th. This company completed its initial public offering on March 2020 and soon became part of the composite index. Although one-time option grants are not unusual in connection with an IPO, the grant value of $27 million option award made to the CEO raised significant concerns. While 1/5 of the option grant had immediate vesting and the remaining had graded long-term vesting schedule with laddered exercise prices, the magnitude of this award, along with the annual vesting tranches, was still considered problematic. As Rachel mentioned about option repricing and option exchange programs, even we did not see many companies opting for that route in the Canadian market. However, there was one company, Cineplex, which implemented an option exchange program for cash payment due to the significant decline in the company's common share price, which was associated with the material impact of COVID on the business. There was no shareholder approval which was sought for this program. Similar to the US market, problematic severance payments and one-time awards remained under scrutiny in the Canadian market. Vermilion Energy received only 42% support from its shareholders and was flagged due to one-time grants to the new executives and inadequate disclosure of severance payment of $4.8 million to former CEO. Another company worth mentioning here is Bombardier, whose one-year TSR was -75%, while the company paid over $16 million of one-time cash payments to its NEOs in 2020. This included a severance payment of $11.8 million, which was paid to the departing CEO.
Thanks, Fushima. So as we've heard, there were indeed some quite significant developments and some high-profile votes in executive compensation, including but not only coming from the impacts of the pandemic. So we'll look forward to further analysis of these issues in our two post-season reports, which will be available to clients over the coming weeks. So thank you, Rashima and Rachel, for sharing your proxy season insights in this, our 2021 US and Canada Compensation Review podcast. And that ends our Bulletin Call podcast for today. Thanks to our speakers, and thanks most of all to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We hope you found this useful and informative. Please watch your emails over the course of the coming weeks for information on and links to the final episodes of this season's podcast series. And as I said, also the release of our post-season reports as they come up over the following weeks. From all of us at ISS, thanks again for listening and goodbye.